Good Monday. It's the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. I'm Phil Picardi on this August 25th. Coming up on the podcast, Minnesota Senate candidates spar over mining. St. Paul considers tighter restrictions on cheap cigars. And we have more stadium news. First, thousands of school kids are back in class. Minneapolis, Edina, and dozens of other districts started the school year today. They've gotten state permission to resume prior to Labor Day. Most Minnesota schools open next week. Thousands of freshmen are moving into the University of Minnesota dorms today. Alex Friedrich has more.
Last year, the U restructured its welcoming program, packing it with activities, but also giving students downtime and a chance to sleep in the mornings. Participation rates went up, so orientation director Beth Lindgren-Clark says the U is keeping those changes. She says welcoming activities give first-year students the chance to start making meaningful connections with others at the U.
They feel like they have someone there to support them. They can ask questions of them. They're more likely to have a successful experience on campus.
She says she hopes Welcome Week can improve the percentage of freshmen who make it through their first year. Alex Friedrich, Minnesota Public Radio News.
State education officials will release scores from the latest round of the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessment Tests tomorrow. Tim Post reports.
Taken in the spring, results of the MCA show how students are measuring up to state standards in math, reading, and science. The scores will also offer the latest look at the achievement gap between white students and students of color. Education officials use the MCAs to identify struggling schools that need help from the state to improve performance. Some districts will also use the scores to measure how well teachers are doing as part of the state's new teacher evaluation system that goes into effect this fall. In recent years, there's been growing concern over the amount of time students in Minnesota and across the country spend on assessment testing. Both the state and federal departments of education are looking at ways to reduce the amount of testing in the future. Tim Post, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Housing and government leaders breaking ground today on an affordable housing development along the Green Line light rail line in St. Paul. Laura Ewan has more.
The end of the automobile era on University Avenue doesn't get more symbolic than this. Project for Pride and Living is building a transit-oriented development on the site of the former Midway Chevrolet used car lot. The complex will be called Hamlin Station in honor of the light rail stop across the street. The nonprofit developer's executive director is Paul Williams, the city's former deputy mayor. He says the $28 million development will help lift the economically challenged area.
It's actually going to be a very striking project, which is going to send, I think, a statement to the marketplace and to the neighborhood about kind of the quality and what's possible here. So we really view it as a catalytic project.
Hamlin Station will include retail and more than 100 rental units, including supportive housing for the formerly homeless. Laura Ewan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Mayo Clinic will be the first healthcare system to offer a new DNA screening test for colorectal cancer. Here's Elizabeth Baer.
Right now, a colon cancer screening takes time to prep for and then go through the actual exam in a doctor's office. The new test, called Cologuard, is the first screening test for colon cancer that doesn't require a doctor's exam or procedure. Mayo gastroenterologist David Alquist says colon cancer is one of the most preventable but least prevented cancers because patients are not getting screened as recommended. He hopes this test that people can take at home will change that.
It's simple and easy to use for patients. It's non-invasive, and ultimately it should be widely accessible.
Cologuard will be available to Mayo Clinic patients in Rochester by early October. Elizabeth Baer, Minnesota Public Radio News, Rochester.
The city of Minneapolis is expected to pay more than $100,000 to settle personal injury claims in two cases involving the city's police department. Brad Williams reports.
In one case, a 15-year-old girl alleges she was beaten up by two police officers in March of 2013. The girl's mother filed a civil suit in federal court, which was settled earlier this week for $22,500. Minneapolis City attorneys also agreed to pay $40,000 to a man who resigned from a police training program in 2007. The man sued the city, claiming a police supervisor made defamatory statements about him and ruined his chances of getting hired by another police department. In a third suit settlement, the city is set to pay a man $18,000 after an employee in a city vehicle rear-ended the man's car. And attorneys agreed Minneapolis should pay $28,000 to three women injured when a car they were riding in collided with a city recycling truck 4 years ago. The city council has to sign off on the payments. Brant Williams, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
The voting window closes today for state-subsidized personal care assistants who are deciding if they want to form a union. Tim Pugmire is in St. Paul.
An estimated 27,000 in-home health care workers were eligible to vote this month on whether to have collective bargaining representation from the Service Employees International Union. The State Bureau of Mediation Services will count the ballots on Tuesday. Union opponents tried to stop the election from moving forward, claiming an infringement on their rights of free political expression and association. But a federal judge denied their request for a preliminary injunction last week. He said the legal challenge was premature because the outcome of the vote is unknown. A state law enacted in 2013 authorized union elections for both PCAs and in-home child care providers. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
A husband and wife team from Ely have embarked on a 100-day, 2,000-mile canoe trip to Washington, D.C. They're doing it to raise awareness for what they say is needed protection of the boundary waters. We have details from Dan Crocker.
Dave and Amy Freeman are paddling to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the passage of the Wilderness Act. Dave Freeman says proposed copper-nickel mines could cause significant water pollution in the nation's most visited wilderness.
We need to tell people our story and why this place is important, why it needs to be protected for the next 50 years.
Frank Ongaro, director of Mining Minnesota, calls the trip a diversion.
And our focus will be on environmentally responsible projects, bringing long-term jobs to northeastern Minnesota.
The Freemans plan to paddle to Grand Portage, then sail across Lake Superior before paddling through Ottawa, Montreal, and New York en route to Washington. They plan to speak in communities along the way and collect signatures on their canoe in support of their cause. Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News, Duluth.
Copper-nickel mining on the Iron Range is an issue in the Minnesota Senate race. For almost a decade, PolyMet has been seeking permission to open a mining operation near Hoyt Lakes. Republicans are blaming Democrats for the slow regulatory process. Most Democrats say they support the proposed mine, but they want to ensure that it won't cause pollution. Mark Zedeklik has more.
A central theme of Republican Senate candidate Mike McFadden's campaign is that Senator Al Franken, President Obama, and other Democrats are strangling the nation's economy by overregulating businesses. If the government would lighten up, McFadden argues, the economy would take off. On the national level, McFadden cites the Keystone Pipeline as a job-creating project that should have proceeded by now. Locally, he singles out the proposed PolyMet copper nickel mine as an example of a project the government is needlessly delaying. He pressed the point during his national Republican rebuttal to President Obama's weekly radio address earlier this month.
Whether it's the PolyMet mine in Minnesota or the Keystone Pipeline, there are good-paying jobs waiting to be created if we just use more common sense in regulation.
PolyMet says if it's allowed to open the mine in northeastern Minnesota, it'll spend almost a half of $1 billion on construction, and after that, employ 360 people with what it calls high-quality, stable mining jobs. After visiting the proposed site last week, McFadden said if he's elected to the Senate, he will immediately direct the Environmental Protection Agency and other federal agencies to expedite the approval process for the mine. McFadden says it's crazy that several different agencies are responsible for making the decision.
The idea that it's taken 8 years and $200 million and we don't have an answer is the definition of being unduly burdensome.
And McFadden accused Franken of not supporting PolyMet's effort and instead pandering to environmentalists who oppose it.
I support the mines. I will get these mines open. I will work hard to do that. Senator Franken has been in Washington 6 years. He's not done anything actively to get these mines open.
I guess my response is that this is the right way to do it.
Franken says he talks with PolyMet officials all the time and that the permitting process has not been unnecessarily arduous.
You don't approve a project before all the agencies say, yeah, this works. This works. And that's I'm I'm pretty optimistic that we're going to get there. But I don't, you know, I think it's irresponsible to say something like this could have been done, you know, years ago.
And Franken says just ask PolyMet. The company will tell you the regulatory process is working.
My name is Brad Moore. I'm Executive Vice President for Environmental and Government Relations for PolyMet Mining.
Moore says PolyMet will not get involved in political battles such as Minnesota's Senate race. But he adds that since the mine project was first proposed, Republican and Democratic elected officials on the state and federal levels have been supportive.
It has been a very long process, typically is in America, but in going through that process, the project has improved. The environmental compliance or environmental impacts are lessened. And as a result, we are going to be sure to meet all state and federal requirements in order to actually operate the mine.
The PolyMet proposal is complicated. Among other things, it involves a land swap with the U.S. Forest Service. Moore says the scope of the project requires involvement from many state and federal government agencies.
We have been pleased with the level of coordination between the agencies. They're appropriately tough on us, but they've also been fair.
As for McFadden's promise to direct federal agencies to fast-track permitting for PolyMet, Al Franken says senators lack that power and that McFadden would have a tough time keeping that campaign promise.
I don't think he actually can do that, first of all. So, you know, I think we do need someone in the Senate who knows how things work.
But with hundreds of jobs at stake, McFadden is likely to keep talking about PolyMet, trying to make DFLer Franken play defense in an area of the state where Democrats traditionally count on lots of support at election time. Mark Sedeklik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The St. Paul City Council votes this week on a proposal to restrict the sale of low-priced cigars. Supporters say the proposed ordinance will help keep tobacco out of the hands of kids, but business interests in the city say it'll just drive legitimate customers to other cities. Brooklyn Center became the first Minnesota city to pass a similar regulation earlier this year. Curtis Gilbert reports on how it's working.
Tiara Brown just popped into Brooklyn Center's Royal Tobacco Shop for some Swisher Sweets.
But y'all have a sale right now, $3 for a 5-pack, right?
It's actually $4 today. The store can charge whatever it wants for a 5-pack, but that's not the case anymore for single cigars and cigarillos. They used to go for 50 cents or a dollar. Now, if they're in packs of four or less, the minimum charge is $2.10 per cigar. The ordinance took effect in June, and store owner Mike Wazwaz says it's killing his business.
We lost about, I want to say, 20,000 in sales a month.
And Wazwaz says it's not just tobacco retailers who are suffering.
For me, it's just a tax on poor smokers. Rich smokers can afford to smoke in Brooklyn Center. The poor smokers cannot.
The ordinance was crafted to target a specific type of low-income smoker, children. Police Commander Tim Gannon says before the ordinance change, cheap cigars were way too accessible for young smokers.
And I've seen this in my own work throughout the city. I've seen people come in of age because they're purchasing in front of a police officer, but they simply throw down change on a countertop. And they have enough change in their pocket to buy a single cigarillo. And I just wonder where that cigarillo ends up at. Does it go out to somebody maybe younger that can't afford more expensive cigarettes?
The cigar wrappers can also be used to smoke marijuana. Cigarillos are smaller and much cheaper than traditional premium cigars, and they're less regulated than cigarettes. For instance, cigarillos and other small cigars come in a variety of fruity flavors, including pineapple, kiwi, and tropical fusion. The federal government banned most flavored cigarettes in 2009 because they were deemed too attractive to children. But it made no such rule for cigars. And while cigarette smoking is declining among middle school and high school students, cigar smoking isn't. A survey from the state health department found cigars are now almost as popular among underage smokers as cigarettes. And cigar smoking rates are dramatically higher among children living in poverty. St. Paul has required cigarettes to be sold in packs since 2006. Prior to that, some stores would let you buy them one at a time if you wanted. Alicia Leisinger, with the Ramsey Tobacco Coalition, says the proposed cigar ordinance follows the same logic.
Kids can't just dig in their couch cushions for that 50 cents or that dollar that they might have. It means that they have to commit to, you know, $5 or $6 to be able to purchase these products.
Business groups are trying to block the proposed ordinance. Matt Kramer is president of the St. Paul Area Chamber of Commerce. He says the policy won't help St. Paul kids, just retailers in other cities.
This creates an enormous unfair playing field where if you are on one side of a city street, let's say city of St. Paul, and the other side is Maplewood, Roseville, Minneapolis, all of a sudden two retail establishments that might be 50 feet apart have different processes for how they can sell something. That's not a very effective way to regulate commerce.
Brooklyn Center's experience lends support to Kramer's argument. Taha Abushnene owns Tobacco King in neighboring Brooklyn Park. The ordinance change gave his business a bump.
I've seen some new faces, some customers, some people say, oh, I used to go to Brooklyn Center, but after the increase, I switched to come over here.
Abushnene estimates his sales of low-end cigars are up 15% or so. The Holiday gas station and convenience store chain also reports double-digit increases in cigar sales at one of its Brooklyn Park locations, while sales at its Brooklyn Center stores are slumping. The concerns from businesses have a familiar ring for Doug Blonkey. He directs the Public Health Law Center at St. Paul's William Mitchell College of Law. And Blonkey says retailers' concerns about tobacco regulations are often overblown.
You know, we heard this, of course, when we talked about smoking in restaurants and bars. And every time a community has taken on any kind of tobacco control measure.
Blonkey predicts that if St. Paul follows Brooklyn Center's lead on cigar regulations, other cities will too. And he'd like to see Minnesota adopt the policy statewide. Curtis Gilbert, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The Minnesota Vikings plan to spend an additional $20 million for their new stadium under construction in Minneapolis. The additional money helps fill out the team's design wish list, but not the wishes of one advocacy group. Reporter Tim Nelson filed this story late Friday.
Since late last year, the Vikings have pledged millions more toward the downtown stadium's construction. This fourth installment brings the Vikings' total contribution to $526 million. That's more than 51% of the cost to build the replacement for the Metrodome. It's also about 10% more than the $477 million the team originally offered. Lester Bagley is the Vikings spokesman.
This is a process, and as we've gone through, and again, to maintain the iconic design, and the numbers came in not where we expected. This was a difficult discussion and decisions, but you know, we're excited about where it's headed.
The contributions to the more than $1 billion project by taxpayers in Minneapolis and across Minnesota were capped at $498 million in 2012. The Vikings have had to close the gap as costs have inched upwards. John Wood, Senior Vice President for Mortenson Construction, said there were a number of factors that have gone into the additional cost. He said the steel for the building's exterior shell has been rising in price, in part because of an improving construction climate and more demand for steel than when the project started.
We budgeted that steel at about $4,800 a ton. And there's about 7,000 tons of steel in that particular element of the building. Those bids came in around $6,000 a ton.
Builders say the increased cost put pressure on other components of the stadium's design, which the Vikings wanted. They include things like an air curtain to keep the stadium at a comfortable temperature, even when the massive doors on the west end of the stadium are opened. They're also upgrading the equipment that will open and close the 10-story high pivoting glass doors. But speaking of glass, the upgrades will not include what conservationists are calling bird-safe glass. It's a textured glazing that is believed to prevent birds from flying into the sides of buildings and being killed. Minnesota Sports Facilities Authority Chair Michelle Kelm-Helgen says the textured or fritted glass has drawbacks.
The fritted glass has always been an issue not only related to cost, but also related to the design of the building. The fritted glass gives you a murky view as you look in, as you look out, and we have decided that from a design standpoint, it's really important that we keep the characteristics of the building.
The Audubon Society's Minnesota chapter appealed to the Vikings to make the building safer for birds. Executive Director Matthew Anderson said he wished the team would have chipped in just a little more.
The $1 million is less than 0.1% of the entire project. And, you know, I don't know how hard it would have been to go from 20 to 21 million, but it would have made a huge difference and would have, I think, put the stadium on the map for all the right reasons.
Anderson says his organization will appeal to Governor Mark Dayton next week. Besides the new cash, the Viking Stadium also got a new operator today. The Stadium Authority picked Pennsylvania-based SMG to manage the building on behalf of the state and the Vikings when it opens in 2016. That's a change from the Metrodome, which was run by the now-defunct Metropolitan Sports Facilities Commission. SMG operates four NFL stadiums, including Soldier Field in Chicago and the Superdome in New Orleans. Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And that is the NPR News Update for Monday, August 25th. I'm Phil Picardi. Thanks for coming along. Tuesday's news right back here tomorrow.